It's poverty.
It's crime.
Unemployment.
Corruption.
Accountability.
The energy crisis.
Inflation.
We are worried.
That South Africa has myriad problems on all fronts is a given. But the time has come for us to look for real solutions. I'm Jeremy Maggs, and this MoneyWeb podcast will discuss those solutions on how South Africans can solve problems by having tough conversations and drawing on the insights of South Africa's top business leaders. Welcome to Fix SA. So here's an issue. Can we use the past to improve the present and design the future? That question is asked by my guest, Dr. Alistair Mokoena, in his new book, Servings of Self-Mastery. Before we talk about that, let me tell you a little bit about him. Alistair has over 25 years of corporate experience in various roles and industries, including FMCG, banking, media, and technology. As the country director for Google South Africa, he oversees the platforms that Google's commercial operations in Southern Africa occupy and also collaborates with customers and social partners to accelerate Africa's digital transformation. We'll get to that a little later. He also is passionate about bridging the digital divide and ensuring that South Africa and Africa benefits from technology. Very warm welcome to you. I'm Jeremy Maggs, Fix SA, where we ask our guests how we can make things better, how do we improve matters, and how in the shortest space of time, because many guests on this podcast have said time is running out, how can we become more competitive and a successful nation once again. Alistair Mokoena, a very warm welcome to Fix SA. And I'm going to wade straight in and I'm going to take an excerpt from your book. And this is what you write. History teaches us about our past and origins. It helps us define our identity and it explains why things are the way they are. You go on to write, there are many useful lessons in history that we need to implement today. Against that backdrop, how can we use that philosophy, that thinking, to fix South Africa?
Hello to all the listeners. Thank you for that. I think for me, what's really important is that unless we take lessons from the past, we're very likely to repeat the same mistakes, right? So I think as a country, as a nation, we've got a very difficult and a painful past that's taught us a lot of things about how not to live together, you know, how not to treat certain sections of the population and so on, and how to actually become an example of unity and social cohesion. So I think there are a lot of good lessons that we can learn from the past. So I think we need to ensure that we don't eradicate remnants of the past and things that remind us of what we need to avoid going forward. So in kind of thinking about shaping the future, I think we must take the lessons with us.
What kind of lessons are you talking about?
So I think, for example, the future of any nation rests squarely on access to good education. So you want to make sure that you have a thriving nation and a prosperous economy. Everybody in the country has to have access to great education. Now, we know that in the past, Black people in South Africa were subjected to inferior education, i.e. Bantu education. There was a systemic process to ensure that Black people are marginalized and condemned to being blue-collar workers. Now, we look at our economy today with a lazy GDP growth of 0.4%, unemployment of 37%, and Gini coefficient of 64%. We are the face of economic inequality in the world. And we have a lot of job opportunities, but we don't have enough skilled people. And that's a remnant of the past. That's a consequence of where we've come from. So I think that's one of the lessons. And I think also to have low crime rates, we need to ensure that there's equity and there's equitable distribution of wealth in the economy. We cannot persist to live in a world of two societies where you have millions of the have-nots, and then you've got a very few haves, and never the two shall meet. So I think we need to learn lessons about how do we create equity in society? How do we create diversity and inclusion? And I think our past is very instructive on what we need to do going forward.
All right. So let me push you a little bit on education, because you're not the first person to raise the inequality as far as that particular sector is concerned. So I'm giving you the magic wand. I'm giving you some money to fix it. Where would you start?
So I would start with early childhood development, you know, the foundation of all education, of all learning. I would ensure that every child in the country has a fair chance. I mean, if I look at the African continent, you know, UNESCO tells us that 9 million girl children are deprived of education and 6 million boys are deprived of education. We've got a high dropout rate of 20%, you know, in the ages below 12. The dropout rate is 40% if you look at the youth. So I would ensure that at an early phase, we have great foundations for all the kids. But equally important is nutrition. So, you know, well-being and learning and sustenance, all those things go together. So ensure that everybody is well-nourished and has a great start to their education process. I would ensure there's equity in the schools. I would ensure that all the schools are properly resourced and also support private sector, because the private sector generates a lot of innovation. So I would make it easy for people to start schools, to start colleges, to start universities. And very, very importantly, the issue that we have in the country is that our education system produces people that want to go to university, and there isn't enough regard for TVET colleges, which trains people, you know, to be artisans, to be business owners, to be job creators. So I think we need to tilt the scale and ensure that a lot of our young people see a great future in TVET colleges, in kind of, you know, practical training where they can actually go out and grow the economy as opposed to go out looking for jobs. So I think for me, that would be a huge focus. I would resource TVET colleges. I would make them attractive. I would also ensure that the, you know, curriculum gives a nod to the most important skills that the world is looking for today. We shouldn't just be thinking about producing future workers or leaders or entrepreneurs for the African continent, but how do we become a net exporter of talent? How do we become a next exporter of products? You know, so STEM education is very important. So we need also to ensure that we improve our throughput rate. We have great quality teachers who have great jobs, who are paid well. Teaching needs to be seen as a viable and attractive profession, and not a profession that you go to out of desperation.
And that, I think, is probably the most important part of that argument. Your entire treatise here is predicated on making sure that the skills are imparted effectively. Part of the problem that we have in this country, of course, Alistair, and you will concede, is that the cohort of teachers is not necessarily the right one. And that's where our children are often let down.
Absolutely. So I think, again, that's a hangover from the past, but the past should not be used as an excuse to justify our current failings. We've had, you know, more than two decades of democracy. We've had an opportunity to overhaul the education system, which we have. So there's been some gains. There's been some improvements. The matric pass rate has improved. But I think the question always is around, how do we elevate, you know, quality across the board? How do we increase competency across the board? How do you drive motivation? How do you have teachers that love what they do? How do you have pupils and learners that want to be in school? So I think, you know, if we want kids to be in school, we want schools to have windows and not, you know, have like draft coming in winter. We don't want to have pit latrines. We want to have proper toilets. Mm. We want to have proper nutrition in schools and sports facilities and so on. Those things are key. But I think looking at the cohort of teachers, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. There's great teachers. Many of us have come through very, very good teachers who have done their best with minimal resources. So I think a lesson going forward is great education must be ubiquitous, must be universally accessible, it must be affordable. And hopefully we can get to a point where education is free, because it is a birthright, it's a constitutional right.
So affordable and accessible is critical as far as this debate is concerned. And a lot of that would be eased if we had better technology in the classroom. Obviously, given your position, you would be someone that preaches the gospel of technology in education. Yet the problem remains is that we don't have enough tech in schools. Why is that?
So you're absolutely right, Jeremy. I think, you know, Google's mission is to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and helpful. And I can tell you from my own personal experience, when I was doing my MBA, when I was doing my PhD, I used Google Scholar for many of my references. It's freely available, it's there. But again, access is a big problem. When you have high data costs, when you have expensive smartphones, when you have low bandwidth and slow internet speeds, when you have low internet penetration, then access is undermined. And also when the language that you speak is not represented in technology platforms, you are restricted in terms of access. So we need to fix that. And I think all the players, whether it's tech companies, governments, private society, and, you know, civil society, and manufacturers of devices, everybody has to come together and ensure that equitable and affordable access becomes a reality. And that's why you'll see people investing in subsea cables, investing in data centers. All of that is aimed at increasing, internet access, making it accessible, making it faster, more reliable, so that there's access for everybody. And we know how expensive these things are. But I think where there's political will, there will be investment. And if I tell you South Africans spend 9.5 hours on the internet every day, the global average is 6.5 hours. So we've got people that have a desire, have a yearning, and they have found utility in the net. Because for Africans to be able to compete with the rest of the world, we all need to have digital access. Out of 1.3 billion Africans, only 580 million Africans are on the net. You know, so we've got another 800 million people to bring online. And we know that by 2050, 1 in 3 young people around the world will come from the continent. And that requires serious investment in infrastructure, in adoption of technology, investment in human capital, ensuring that we lift the skills, improvement in basic services, like access to even government services. So that's why I'm excited that our country recently published a paper on South Africa's AI strategy, which starts to look at things like, how do you regulate AI? How do you ensure that there's ethical AI deployment and it's responsible? How do you ensure that there's investment in technology, adoption of technology? How do you ensure that AI is socially beneficial? So I think all these things will have an incredible incremental impact on lives and livelihoods.
You talk about political will as far as this technology debate is concerned and accessibility. Do you really believe that it exists, or do you simply believe that lip service is paid to the concept?
So I'm in a fortunate position of having to work very closely in an ecosystem of partners. So we work very closely with government leaders from the president down. We talk about digital technology. And we're very fortunate as the African continent that as recent as March, African leaders got together at the 38th AU summit in Addis Ababa, where the big topic of discussion was, how does Africa lean into digital technology to accelerate Africa's growth? And then also the work that's been done by the African Continental Free Trade Area is also looking at creating a digital market across the continent, and they're developing protocols to ensure that it's safe, it's helpful, and so on. So I think we're seeing that there's a shift. We're seeing that the implementation of South Africa's 4IR, you know, commission's recommendations is happening. We've seen the launch of AI hubs at TUT and UJ, and these are looking at very basic things that answer the call of the UN when the nations of the world came together and developed the 7 sustainable development goals. And we know that 80% of those goals are off track. So there's a massive need to accelerate progress on all those goals, to eradicate inequality in the world, poverty, to silence the guns, to ensure that we've got a sustainable environment that we can bequeath to the next generation. So I think from a political perspective, I'm getting a real sense and I'm seeing tangible, you know, will to accelerate things. Our internet penetration has grown luckily over the last 5 years to 74%. What the Minister of Communications and Data Technology tells us now is with the SA Connect project, we're connecting more townships and rural areas, and we'll get it to about 85% and eventually 90 in the next, you know, 3-4 years. We've seen e-commerce grow in the country. Before COVID, e-commerce was only 1.4% of all retail sales. Fast forward to now, e-commerce is about 6% of retail sales, growing at a CAGR of 10%. So by 2027, we think e-commerce will be 10% of retail sales. Now, the convenience of that is one thing, but the ability of small businesses to trade with the rest of the world and access markets, that's only made available by e-commerce. So I think there's a lot of that happening. I think, you know, when big tech companies invest in subsea cables and data centers, that's a political will to say access is important. Yes, it makes commercial sense. It's not a charitable act. It's an act around digitizing Africa so that we have everybody on the net and Africa can compete with the rest of the world.
I suppose it's not just the big tech companies and corporate South Africa generally getting involved in this, but it's also up to individuals who have the wherewithal, who have the means also to roll up their sleeves and get involved. And to that extent, you're doing some work in two tertiary institutions, Rhodes University in Makanda and also the Northwest University, if I'm not mistaken. Very briefly, what are you doing in that respect? But more importantly, in terms of the fix, what lessons could individuals learn from that outreach?
So, you know, Jeremy, I'm a Christian, and one of my favorite pieces of scripture is Luke 12, verse 48, that says, "To whom much is given, much shall be required." I was privileged to go to Rhodes University and get my BCom and LLB degrees. And I know there's a huge funding shortage. I did my PhD at Northwest University, and I know there's a huge funding shortage. I sit on the UJ Council. So I'm very aware of the challenges in the tertiary education sector. So, you know, I thought about it for a long time. Wife and I discussed it. We decided that actually we should put money aside to invest in people's education. So we've created the Alistair Makwena Education Fund, which is now funding students at those two institutions. And the idea is to not create a movement, because the movement exists, but to join a movement of givers and encourage other people to also come on board and contribute to those things and create their own funds. Because, you know, the problems that we face today as society are human-made problems, and therefore it'll take humans to solve the problems. And that's why I wrote this book, Servings of Self-Mastery, because I believe in the power of one. If each one of us leans into our own agency to be the difference that we desire, incrementally, all 63 million South Africans can make a big difference. You know, so investing in education is one. My father used to play for Kaizer Chiefs in the 70s, and we now have a Johnny Mukwena Football Foundation that invests in township soccer. Again, that's about identifying a gap and an area that you feel passionate about and doing something about it. And hopefully that kindness and benevolence and passion has a contagion effect, and then other people follow suit.
I'm so glad that you used that word kindness, because also in the book, you speak about the importance of choosing kindness. You go on to say it helps you get more done and expands your sphere of influence. You also talk, Alistair Makwena, about humility, which you contend is effortless when the ego is in check. The problem in South Africa, and perhaps one of the reasons why we are unable to fix things, is we don't choose a path of kindness. And there is more hubris than there is humility. How do we get that right?
So I think we need healing as people. You know, human beings are driven by love and fear, as, you know, Carl Jung taught us. And I think we actually have come a long way as South Africans. We've had a very difficult past. We've tried to deal with it. Some are in a better position than others. But I think when you've got historical wounds, it's very difficult for you to show up in your best form. You can only give what you have. You can only give love if you love yourself. You can only let others shine if you feel self-assured. You know, you can only share if you believe in equality and equity, and that there's enough for all of us, as opposed to always being competitive and adversarial and being driven by a sense of there isn't enough, therefore I need to hog what I have. And whatever savings I have, I must put away for a rainy day, as opposed to, well, life is short, I might not wake up tomorrow, so maybe that big bank account or balance should go to the needy. So those things for me are front and center. And I think it's important to understand that kindness goes a long way. And I think if we make this selfish decisions, whether we're in political leadership roles or business roles or civic society roles, then we're not serving a higher purpose. And I believe true greatness comes from serving a higher purpose. It's not about you, you know, and the resources you have might go tomorrow. I've seen people lose wealth. I've seen powerful leaders lose their positions. So all these things are quite fleeting, if I'm honest.
But Alistair, so many South Africans right now, whether it's load shedding, whether it's about the widening inequality gap, whether it's about a shortage of water, are increasingly raging at the machine. How do we just tamper things down a little bit? Is that doable, or have we got to a point now where there is just so much hostility that it's almost impossible to start fixing things because of that climate that exists?
So as taxpayers, we have a legitimate expectation in our government to do what they are appointed to do. And as citizens of the country, we do have a government that we rely on to have basic services in place. Where there are failings, civil society needs to stand up. And that's why I think having skin in the game is so important. Appealing to your own inner agency to say, I'm going to be part of the solution, is so important. I mean, if I look at a country like Botswana that has community service after matric, where, you know, youngsters are enrolled in different parts of society to learn skills and so on, I think that's actually a model that we should also think about. If I look at the role that some of the NGOs play, like Gift of the Givers, now imagine if you had many of those kind of entities or organizations that rely on volunteerism. So I don't think we have a big enough or pervasive enough culture of volunteerism. I think we need to volunteer. I think we need to learn basic skills. I'm very keen to learn basic plumbing and electrical skills, not just to fix a leaking tap in my house. But if I walk down the street and I see a leaking tap or a leaking pipe, I want to be able, you know, to kind of do something about it. And I think that's what we need. We need tutors. We need mentors. We've got millions of child-headed households, yet we've got a lot of young adults who could play an important role in fixing the social and moral fiber of this nation. So I think it takes for more of us to have our eyes open, to speak up when we see crime, when we see something wrong, when we see inequality. You know, we need to be part of the solution. We need to lead by example. And I think when people see more and more of us stepping up and saying, hey, I want to help fix this thing. I want to speak about this. I want to give of myself. I want to write a book to try and help people think about things and solve issues, we will see more people getting more involved. So I think a culture of volunteerism is what an active citizenry need. But because of, you know, the internet and those kind of things, people have much more access to information. They're much more empowered. They know right from wrong. They know their rights and entitlements. And I think it's important to equip society with that kind of knowledge so that nobody wallows in being a victim, but actually sees a challenge as an opportunity. And let's remember, the biggest innovations in the world are in response to basic failures in society.
Part of that, of course, is predicated on having the right leaders in place, whether they are corporate leaders, civil society leaders, or government leaders. You write that leadership is a commitment to life of serving, guiding, supporting, and inspiring others. You go on to say, Alistair, that you are a well that gives water to others, and you have to look after the well so it never runs dry. I'm not going to make any jokes about Johannesburg's water supply right now, because I suspect you wrote that before we ran into those problems. But having said that, though, do we have that kind of leadership in every aspect or at every level of South African society? I would contend that we don't.
So, you know, there's the X theory of management and the Y theory of management. And X theory says, assumes that employees don't want to do an honest day's work, they're not motivated, whereas Y theory assumes positive intent across the board and works with that. Call me an internal kind of optimist, but I feel like at a fundamental level, all human beings want to do good and be good. Things happen along the way. You know, we compromise, we become selfish, we become tempted, we devalue integrity, we think about self-enrichment, we worry about our pensions, we get hooked on material trappings of success, whether that's blue lights or whether that's a corner office with a little, you know, golf course at the back of your office park. All those things are vices that human beings, as fallible, you know, creatures, are susceptible to. So I understand it, I get it. But yes, we require a higher standard from leaders. And we've seen many, many failures in the country. We've seen corporate scandals. We've seen epic government failures. So as South Africans, we deserve more. All of us need to be better, even those that are in leadership positions. It's not always about, you know, replacing people. Yes, replacing people is also one of the solves, but it's also about people that are in some of these roles having a Damascus moment and saying, what I'm doing is wrong. I need to stop. I need to do better. I've been entrusted with the privilege of leading, but the reciprocal responsibility of doing good and being good cannot be ignored. So I think all of us just need to reflect and say, am I giving the best of myself, or am I shortchanging people? And if I'm shortchanging people, I should either change my ways or I should step aside.
In conclusion, you say that every cloud has a silver lining. I'll give that to you, Alistair. It is a well-worn cliche. But out of that, you say change your perspective and you will be filled with hope. Are you confident that we can change our perspective, that we can be hopeful again? And if we are, we can fix something in this country that is going to set us on a new path?
I really think that we can change our perspective. You know, how we see material success, for example, determines the choices we make. And if we change the way we see material things, if we say, listen, having the biggest car, the biggest house, the biggest bank account is not the most important thing at the end of the day, because these things are fleeting. You might not wake up tomorrow. then we might change the way we do things. We might change our attitude to resources. If we think that being in a position of power is about ruling as opposed to serving, then we might, you know, so I think just changing the perspective and saying, I'm not the ruling party, I'm the serving party. You know, I'm not the CEO, I am the chief servant and leader and inspirer and a purveyor of hope. You know, just reframing things goes a long way in changing our actions. So the head, the heart, and the feet and the hands all have to be in sync, but they have to be driven by the same purpose and the same mission. You do have a choice around which purpose you want to pursue in life. And I think therein lies agency and personal choice and perspective.
And if you're looking for a little more on that, the name of the book is Servings of Self-Mastery, Bite-Sized Pep Talks to Unlock Greatness. The publisher is Tracy McDonald Publishers, and I've been in conversation with Dr. Alistair Mokoena. Alistair, thank you very much for joining me on this edition of Fix SA on MoneyWeb. Thanks for listening to this Fix SA podcast. For more episodes posted every second Friday, go to moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.